Welcome to Constitution Ave, a new podcast where we dive deep into the week's hottest news topics, from the halls of Congress to the Oval Office. I'm Sam Dorman, and these are my co-hosts, Nathan Wester.
Hello there.
And Jacob Berg.
Hello.
Trump's second term has reached its 100-day milestone, so Nathan and Jacob are going to take us through some of the highlights of his time in office. I'll be following them with some information about how the administration is seeking to hold state and local officials accountable for not cooperating with federal authorities. Jacob, Trump has been ambitious in rolling out a significant number of executive orders. What are some of the big ones that we should take note of, and which ones have we maybe not noticed but should have?
Thank you, Sam. Well, I'm Jacob, an aviation and national politics reporter, and as you all might know, the resident Florida man of the group. First, wanted to just say last week, I finally went kayak surfing again for the first time in probably 15 years. And no, guys, I didn't see a shark, nor did I capsize, but I did catch some gnarly waves.
And I hope it wasn't as harrowing as that new Nick Cage surfing movie makes it out to be. There was nobody chanting locals only, right?
Luckily, this Florida man would be the only one screaming about locals. But let's begin on Trump's executive orders. As many of you may already know, and for those of you who don't, this week, Trump reached the 100-day threshold for his second term in the Oval Office. But not only that, Trump signed more executive orders in 100 days than any other president in history, even surpassing the number of orders signed in 4 years by his predecessor, Joe Biden, according to the White House. Now, some celebrate Trump's rapid pace, saying he is making good on his campaign promises before winning the November election last year. Others, particularly Democrats, are concerned and see the quantity and scope of his orders as a sign of Trump drastically reshaping the executive branch in seemingly unprecedented ways, including closing federal agencies without congressional action. Trump has already now signed more than 140 orders, with some driving the media headlines like his mass deportations and even his renaming of the Gulf of Mexico. Others have more or less flown under the radar, so let's explore a few of those today. First, let's look at one focused on a household appliance you might use every day or for others, and trust me, I'm not judging, several times a week. I'm talking about showerheads. Years ago, President Obama restricted water flow from showerheads and other appliances like dishwashers, laundry machines, and toilets. The move was intended to conserve energy and lower consumer utility bills, since hot water, as many of you probably know, is a major source of energy use in an average home. And I don't know about you, but I'm definitely not a fan of cold showers. Trump first loosened those restrictions in his first term, which Biden reversed. This time around, Trump is loosening them again, and his order calls for showerheads to emit 2.5 gallons of water per minute. Another executive order stops the government from issuing and accepting written checks by later this year. While check use is constantly dropping throughout the country, we still write more checks than most other countries combined, with Canada and France being the only two that come close, according to recent data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. And many experts have even pushed for an end to using paper checks, calling them an inherently insecure form of payment. Now, for those of you who like Bitcoin, a third order creates a strategic cryptocurrency reserve. Treasury Secretary Bessent is directed to create an office to maintain and store Bitcoin for the federal government, including any cryptocurrency the government has seized through criminal proceedings or obtained via civil asset forfeiture. Okay, now let's turn our attention to an order from last week, which aims to expand into a new industry, offshore deep-sea mineral mining. The order directs Commerce Secretary Lutnick to surge the exploration for deep-sea mining off the U.S. continental shelf in the Pacific Ocean, while also fast-tracking permits for commercial businesses to explore and mine those areas. Deep-sea mineral deposits come in varying forms, including what are called, and I know this might sound a little technical, but polymetallic nodules, or rather just mineral clumps that are basically the size of potatoes and are rich in nickel, cobalt, manganese, and copper. These clumps take millions of years to develop at depths of miles below sea level. Yes, I said miles. Currently, China dominates the entire world supply chains for nearly all critical minerals, including those found in the deep sea. And as China and the U.S. battle tariffs in an ongoing trade war, China has moved to block its exports of critical minerals to America. Trump's order would increase U.S. mineral production, while also likely allowing private businesses to bypass a United Nations-backed regulatory body that currently creates rules for deep-sea exploration. A 2024 report from the Berkeley Science Journal estimated that an area just to the southeast of Hawaii could have literally 34 billion wet metric tons of these mineral clumps. Now, that's containing metals estimated to be worth roughly, wait for it, $10 trillion. So guys, with those advantages, can any of you guess of any of the downsides?
I know that there have been steps to make mining safer, but are there any risks to the underwater habitats?
Absolutely. As with nearly any form of mining, there is always going to be environmental impacts. The Berkeley report found that deep sea mining could disturb critical habitats for various species that live at the bottom of the ocean. But further, as the mining is carried out, streams of water are shot in and out of the seabed. This leads to water temperatures increasing, oxygen levels dropping, and critically, mineral separation, which sends metals and sediment back into the ocean, which is a form of pollution. Some may even kill zooplankton species, which are a critical food supply for not just many of the fish that Americans like to eat, but also other species that are essential for the marine ecosystem. Now, let's go to my friend and DC-based colleague, Nathan.
Thanks, Jacob. I'm a national politics reporter based in Washington, D.C. I cover a little bit of everything. In 2003, if you'd heard of a certain word, you probably thought of the title held by the rulers of Venice for more than 1,000 years.
The Doge.
A decade later, you would have thought of that cute Shiba Inu dog made famous as an internet meme, Kabosu.
Rest in peace.
You also might have thought of the meme cryptocurrency, Dogecoin, or, in the years to come, the man who promoted it, Elon Musk. Today, Doge is synonymous with Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, a time-limited organization created to curb federal waste, fraud, and abuse.
Doge started out as a meme. Think about it. And now it's real. Isn't that crazy?
That was Elon at CPAC in February. I was at the Gaylord Resort as Argentina's free market president, Javier Milei, handed the wealthiest man in the world his chainsaw, the symbol of their shared mission to downsize the state. But that was then. Now, 100 days into Donald Trump's second presidency, has the meme become reality? How exactly is Doge doing? Some of its reported numbers have come under scrutiny. Musk himself walked back in an early prediction of $2 trillion in savings. For now, Doge and Musk claim to have saved $160 billion. With Tesla sales plunging, Musk will scale back his involvement in Doge over the coming weeks. The organization has been hit by numerous lawsuits. Many concern its access to sensitive information. On April 30th, the Fourth Circuit upheld a court order limiting Doge's access to Social Security data. Doge has also faced protests and opposition from Democrats in Congress. Here's what House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said in his speech marking Trump's first 100 days.
Doge is not the American way. Canceling medical research for children with cancer is cruel. Denying relief for communities reeling from natural disasters is cruel.
Doge targets have included the National Institutes of Health, a source of medical research funding, and AmeriCorps volunteers involved in disaster relief. But Doge has allies on the Hill, too. Republicans may soon advance a package that codifies some, but not all, of the initiative's cuts. It would be hard to cover everything Doge has done in a single segment. Let's zoom in on one department, Health and Human Services. Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s new domain tops the agency efficiency leaderboard at doge.gov. In early April, HHS outlined sweeping changes in line with President Trump's Doge agenda. They include shedding 20,000 employees and centralizing various functions, including human resources. The department is also consolidating various divisions and regional offices. Jacob James Rich, a policy analyst at Reason Foundation, told me he hopes Doge will scrutinize Medicare and Medicaid, two big contributors to federal spending.
At least about 20% of what goes on at those organizations is fraud. Even more of it's waste, but even beyond waste, there's a massive amount of fraud.
In his view, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, unlike most of the government, actually needs more staff, at least in one rather specific area.
But CMS is one of the few agencies within the federal government that actually doesn't quite have enough administration when it comes to auditing what types of payments come out.
We'll see if DOGE takes him up on his advice. The whole DOGE initiative came home to me in a new way a few days ago. I actually ran into some of the DOGE kids on the ground in Washington.
Wow, Nathan, what was that like?
You know, I shouldn't go into too much detail here, but I can say that, not surprisingly, I saw a lot of young faces. One of them told me that, in his words, doging is a way of life. That way of life could continue until July 4th, 2026, when DOGE is set to expire. But I'm sure we'll see more fireworks before then. And now let's hear from Sam, who's going to walk us through conflicts between the Trump administration and other levels of government.
Thanks, Nathan. I'm Sam, and I cover legal issues, which will likely become more common for state and local officials after actions by Trump and his administration. As Trump's 100 days approached, he made clear that he would work to bring legal action against officials who don't cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. That even included judges who faced charges from the Justice Department at the end of April. The FBI arrested Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Duggan after she allegedly interfered with federal law enforcement related to a Mexican national who was previously removed from the United States. According to the Justice Department, Duggan ordered federal agents to leave the Milwaukee County Courthouse where they intended to conduct the arrest. Separately, a former judge was charged in New Mexico for alleged evidence tampering offenses related to a man with purported ties to Tren de Aragua, which is the Venezuelan gang that Trump has targeted for deportations. Shortly after Duggan's arrest, the administration signed an executive order directing the Attorney General to publish a list of sanctuary jurisdictions. Part of the order directed the Justice Department to seek legal action against those who refuse to change. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said that,
"It's quite simple. Obey the law, respect the law, and don't obstruct federal immigration officials and law enforcement officials when they are simply trying to remove public safety threats from our nation's communities."
Immigration, of course, has been a big issue for Trump since he started his 2016 campaign and gave a speech about Mexico sending criminals to the United States. That focus on immigration has been a big theme in his second term as well. As early as February, Attorney General Pam Bondi had announced a lawsuit against New York State officials over the state's use of a quote-unquote green light law. Those are a type of sanctuary policy that prohibit the DMV from sharing information with immigration enforcement agencies unless presented with a court order or warrant. At the time, Bondi warned other jurisdictions they were next if they refused to comply with federal law.
"And if you don't comply with federal law, we will hold you accountable. We did it to Illinois. Strike one. Strike two is New York. And if you are a state not complying with federal law, you're next. Get ready."
And on April 24th, the administration sued the city of Rochester, New York, for hindering cooperation with federal authorities. The lawsuit started by describing how the city's mayor, Malik Evans, criticized local police's decision to assist federal immigration enforcement in March. During a press conference, Evans said,
"These are federal functions, not city functions. So based on my preliminary review of this incident, the officer who responded to the scene may have violated and appears to have violated city policy."
You might say that Evans was courting a potential legal battle with the federal government. It's unclear how Trump's orders will hold up in court. On the same day as the Rochester lawsuit, a federal judge in California blocked one of Trump's orders targeting funding for sanctuary jurisdictions. Both the judge and Evans have pointed to the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, which generally reserves certain powers for states. In a statement, Evans and the city council president suggested Trump was attempting to, quote, commandeer local resources in violation of the Constitution's 10th Amendment. The Trump administration, meanwhile, has pointed to the Supremacy Clause, which generally requires that states follow federal law. Other state and local officials could face legal action under a separate executive order Trump signed in April to bolster law enforcement. That provision ordering the Attorney General to pursue officials who generally direct the obstruction of criminal law. It also targets officials who, quote, unlawfully engage in discrimination or civil rights violations under the guise of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives that restrict law enforcement activity or endanger citizens, unquote. So all in all, a lot of bold action coming from Trump's second administration. Nathan, you and Jacob were discussing some comparisons between Trump and former President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I was wondering if you could expand on that some.
Absolutely. You know, This is a comparison that has been drawn by, among others, Steve Bannon. He's spoken about the notion of the Trump administration's second go-around as kind of an anti-New Deal, an opportunity, as he sees it, to build a new lasting political coalition like that created in the New Deal period. And in the first 100 days of both the Trump and FDR administrations, there were some striking similarities in terms of the, I would say, general efforts to, in a moment of what some see as crisis, reimagine the nature of executive authority and of government. In the opening months of the FDR administration, there were confrontations with the courts, somewhat similar to what we saw with Trump. Of course, FDR's election was also paired with a very sweeping set of defeats for Republicans in both the House and Senate. That meant that more of what came through that presidency, things like the Tennessee Valley Authority Act, the Emergency Banking Act, actually went through the Congress. As compared to the current situation, Republicans did preserve their House majority. They did gain in the Senate, but they don't have anything close to a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. The Congress also for decades now has been far more sclerotic, famously unable to pass a budget. At the same time, FDR also had a lot of EOs. This would include one limiting gold ownership. Early in the presidency, he created the Works Progress Administration, along with the Tennessee Valley Authority and many of these other agencies. These were called the Alphabet Agencies, basically the forerunner in combination with what was set up during the World War II period, also under FDR, for what we would now call the administrative state. And again, it's striking that we see both presidents who have been labeled Caesars, both presidents who have come to office and then executed their jobs in ways that are considered unconventional at the time, so similar and yet so different. Obviously, we don't want to act as though they're exactly parallel, but yeah, Jacob, I'm curious if you see some of these similarities or some key differences here.
Yeah, thanks, Nathan. I wanted to raise probably one of the key differences that I imagine a lot of FDR supporters would probably reference when looking at this analogy, is at least in the, there's two major emergencies in the context of the FDR administration. The first, as we all know, being the Great Depression and the pretty significant economic destruction that the country was facing, the historic levels of unemployment. And in some ways, especially for those who like a lot of the programs the New Deal was advancing, some of these, you know, as you could call them, bold actions were in direct response to that very serious economic crisis that the country was facing. And then the second other major crisis that, as we know, kind of developed as FDR's administration proceeded, World War II. And there was a lot going on to shore up production in the United States and responding to that major geopolitical conflict. But at the same time, there were some notable misses as well, at least for a lot of people. Famously, FDR signed a executive order, 9066, which led to the internment of a lot of Japanese Americans during World War II out of national security concerns. And then even his successor, Harry Truman, signed quite a few executive orders. And one of them led to a court battle. There was one he had signed that wanted to take the U.S. steel mills and put them under federal control. And at the time, the Supreme Court ruled that Truman had overstepped his authority because he had attempted to make something law rather than clarifying an existing piece of legislation. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting comparison. And there's definitely quite a few similarities, but then, as you know, as I noted, probably quite a few divergences. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I think you guys made some good points. Overall, I think that Trump will be remembered as one of the most significant presidents in American history. You know, you can look at FDR, maybe Nixon or Reagan, and just the kind of impact that they've had. And that makes me, some of the things they've done, I guess, in some of the ways that Trump has been compared, he's been compared to some of these historic figures. It'll be interesting to see how his legacy unfolds. And
I do think it's interesting to consider. You were pointing out that the Great Depression was a fairly radical set of economic conditions, precipitating not just the election of FDR, but also, I would say, the whole suite of measures that unfolded, the climate of the country at the time. But again, when I say crisis in the context of what Trump supporters see, first of all, there was some pretty good coverage after the election outlining the fact that, unfortunately, the government statistics didn't really accurately capture how bad things like unemployment and wage growth and overall growth were. Not Great Depression level conditions in 2024, but paired with that persistent inflation and then the lasting effects of inflation, people were taking a hit. But I think a very crucial thing to understand, first of all, is that Trump is in many ways, at least the way that a lot of his supporters would see him and in much of his rhetoric through things like DOGE and through efforts to otherwise scale down the government, a kind of an anti-FDR responding to what people would see in the case of his supporters as failures of this large-scale administrative state. I think things like the response to COVID-19 dictated as it often was from sort of a narrow public health perspective, leading to what many people saw as totally unjustified large-scale campaigns for things like universal masking or a universal vaccination. I think that's a driving force. And finally, a critical issue, rather different from what the country was grappling with in the 1930s, is the scale of, in particular, illegal immigration, but even massive legal immigration. The country right now has the largest foreign-born percentage, not just in terms of absolute numbers, but percentage in its entire history. The last time this was true was in the late 19th century, and that was a time of even more political radicalism. You had the emergence of serious communist and anarchist parties in the United States. So that, I think it's important to, in contextualizing both the similarities and differences, understand that the Trump appeal, such as it is, extends beyond just the economy.
Yeah, and I was actually just thinking, too, if we want to take some past comparisons on Trump's economic actions, we could take a look at FDR's predecessor, Hoover, signing the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930, which, as a lot of lawmakers have pointed out, is one of the closest corollaries in recent political history for the United States, in the same level of tariff imposition that Trump is doing now. At the time, it significantly raised tariffs on imports going to the United States, and a lot of people have argued that it led to a worsening of the conditions that were driving. You know, the beginning of the Great Depression certainly didn't cause the Great Depression, but some have seen it as one of the many impacts that might have made things worse in the beginning. So, yeah, that's one thing I think will be interesting to see play out, because, you know, as we know, the economy wasn't fully recovered last year, was steadily, slowly, and gradually recovering. But, you know, as you pointed out, Nathan, there were still quite a few issues at play. And I think the real key metric to be looking at moving forward will be to see how those tariffs really do long-term impact the U.S. economy, not so much these short-term blips, but really how things are going to be proceeding in the long term. And that, I think, will really give us a good idea of how well we can, you know, kind of see corollaries to past administrations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people are paying attention to at least one short-term blip, the 0.3% GDP contraction. At the same time, as the White House's Peter Navarro has pointed out, there's been a surge in domestic investment. The Trump White House, at least, is talking up automakers reshoring some production. But again, if we see things like sustained issues with the stock market or GDP contraction that continues, any sort of lasting recession, I could imagine there being a rethink on the part of at least some people. Not to continue for too much longer on the FDR comparison or lack of comparison, but again, to the extent that Trump is an anti-FDR, he ran on this notion of the U.S. reducing its foreign entanglements, at least in some cases avoiding war, although we're seeing the strikes on the Houthis right now. And the possibility of conflict with Iran. But FDR's administration, both in that pre-World War II period where there were escalatory dynamics on both sides. There's you know, evidence, for example, that the administration had some notion of what ended up being this massive shock to the country ahead of time. But in addition to that, you had the creation, essentially, of the modern international system. And Trump has pretty explicitly gone about repudiating aspects of that. So that's, you know, whether or not you think either are justified independently or in the context of their time or not justified, that really stands out when I try to make sense of Trump as this a figure attempting, in many respects, a large-scale reversal of elements of that New Deal and then a World War II program.
All right. Well, a lot to consider there. Thank you for listening to Constitution Ave with Jacob Berg, Nathan Wester, and Sam Dorman. Join us next week for the most intriguing topics in news and politics, and be sure to subscribe and rate us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.